Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Over the following 40 years, this organization, which had some roots in the Southern Baptist Church, added oil interests and the DeVos family and various other economic and political forces to form the Council for National Policy, which was is a coordinating body that has helped to transform the Republican Party into a much more ultra-right organization than it was 40 years ago. Most people have not heard of the Council for National Policy because they've intentionally been off the radar for most of this time. But when Trump was preparing to go to the Republican convention last week, the big major speech that he gave the Friday before the convention was for the Council for National Policy.
Who do you think is pulling Biden's strings? Is it former Obama officials?
People that you've never heard of. People that are in the dark shadows, people that...
What does that mean? That sounds like conspiracy theory, dark shadows.
No, people that you haven't heard of. They're people that are on the streets. They're people that are controlling the streets. We had somebody get on a plane from a certain city this weekend. And in the plane, it was almost completely loaded with thugs wearing these dark uniforms, black uniforms with gear and this and that. They're on a plane.
Where is this?
I'll tell you sometime, but it's under investigation right now.
Hey, Parallax Views listeners. What you just heard were Donald Trump's recent comments in a Fox News interview claiming that Joe Biden, his rival in the 2020 race to the White House, is being controlled and directed by people in the dark shadows. But maybe Trump and the GOP have some dark shadows of their own, or at least that's the conclusion you'll probably draw after hearing Ann Nelson, veteran journalist and author of the new book, Shadow Network: Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. In this book, Anne hones in on a secretive organization known as the Council for National Policy, which, according to one of its foundational members, has been waging a long-term war for the soul of the Republican Party. And they've been doing so under the radar, or if you prefer, in the dark shadows. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome to Parallax Views. Ann Nelson, author of the new book, Shadow Network: Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. How are you doing today, Ann?
Fine, thanks. I'm talking to you from Oklahoma.
So, Ann, you know, it's interesting that we're doing this interview about your book, Shadow Network, especially in light of Donald Trump recently giving an interview with Laura Ingraham, where he was talking about people in the dark shadows who are controlling the Biden campaign. And even Laura Ingraham, a right-wing talk show host, said to him, that sounds like conspiracy theory.
I think you're talking about some different shadows, though, than the ones that Trump is talking about.
Oh, I'm afraid that contemporary America has plenty of shadows to go around. but when I'm talking about shadow network in my book, I'm talking about a very specific group of people who started four decades ago or more, and initially they were going to try to take over the Southern Baptist Convention, the Southern Baptist churches and it was kind of based in Texas. And like the other Protestant denominations, the Southern Baptists were liberalizing. And in the 1970s, they were accepting the civil rights movement and becoming more progressive about women. And there was a backlash. And there were several people in the church who decided to organize what they called the Conservative Resurgence. And they developed these political tactics that were really interesting. They launched a disinformation campaign against their rivals in the church, and they would organize voters and bus them in to vote on church policies, and they purged moderates from influential positions in the seminaries and replaced them with conservatives. And it worked. They took over the Southern Baptist Church and rolled it back decades. And not long after that, they set their sights on the Republican Party, and they used the same techniques. And over the following 40 years, this organization, which had some roots in the Southern Baptist Church, added oil interests and the DeVos family and various other economic and political forces to form the Council for National Policy, which was is a coordinating body that has helped to transform the Republican Party into a much more ultra-right organization than it was 40 years ago. Most people have not heard of the Council for National Policy because they've intentionally been off the radar for most of this time. But when Trump was preparing to go to the Republican convention last week, the big major speech that he gave the Friday before the convention was for the Council for National Policy.
Now, I want to get into the CNP, but first I want to note something. I think the issue of the new right in America is a bit unusual, because I've always heard people say, how could we have gotten to this point with Donald Trump, as if Donald Trump is an aberration? And on the other hand, I hear people say, the Republican Party wasn't always this way. And it wasn't always representative of the sort of Trump contingency, although it has been for a long time. And in your book, you actually reference another book by a key figure in Shadow Network, Richard Viguerie. And he wrote a book, I believe in 2014, entitled Takeover: The 100-Year War for the Soul of the GOP and How Conservatives Can Finally Win It. Maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar, what is this war he's talking about? How does this relate to things like the Goldwater campaign? Things are not as simple as people think when it comes to the history of the Republican Party in the 20th century.
Absolutely. And that's such a good point. If you're looking at even the Eisenhower administration, which was Republican, and the two parties in the mid-20th century, there was a lot of overlap. There were Republicans who were liberal and who supported things like public health insurance. Richard Nixon founded the Environmental Protection Agency. There were Democrats who were more conservative, and you just had the two parties that could have a conversation and could work together to make policy. And that started to be problematic. Certainly the Goldwater campaign was one where Goldwater was to the right of the party, and he didn't have as much support in the party as someone like Eisenhower.
Could I interrupt real quick? I wanted to mention something. During the Goldwater campaign, isn't this around the time where I guess people like Phyllis Schlafly, who was just the subject for the prestige television series Mrs. America recently, She would refer to these moderate Republicans as Rockefeller Republicans. They were seen as too moderate, and these hyper-conservatives like Phyllis Schlafly do not have much love for this moderate wing of the Republican Party. And I think that's where a lot of the Goldwater base comes from, correct?
Yeah, and in Shadow Network, I talk a lot about regionalisms. Now, remember, Goldwater was from Arizona, and a lot of the Reagan Republicans, you know, there was a great deal of effort in Texas, and that's not a coincidence because it's a period where the oil industry was starting to push back against the environmental movement. So Rockefeller was from New York. So there were Rockefeller Republicans who were strong environmentalists. You had Romney in Massachusetts, who was very progressive in terms of health insurance and so on. And so there was a regional split going on in the Republican Party. And so going back to Richard Viguerie, there were three young men, he was one of them, who were involved in the Goldwater campaign. Morton Blackwell was another, and Paul Weyrich was the third. And they were deeply disappointed by Goldwater's loss, and they went into a huddle and decided that what they needed was a long-term strategy. And they were all strategists. Richard Viguerie really invented modern direct marketing for political purposes and, you know, created this whole way of using direct mail and fundraising and so on that grew out of the Goldwater campaign. This was, again, at the same time that Phyllis Schlafly was trying to build a coalition that was a backlash against the women's movement. And again, in the Southwest, you know, in Mrs. America, you see her going to Oklahoma and finding fundamentalist women who would join her cause. And so what I talk about in the book is how there had been a New Deal coalition that was about, you know, civil rights leaders, trade unionists, etc., who supported those reforms. Well, what these men did, along with people like Phyllis Schlafly, was create a new coalition among the forces of the backlash and put together political structures and campaigns based on that that became very powerful at the same time that the New Deal coalition was eroding out of old age.
Now, really quickly, since we didn't get to mention it, how was Goldwater different from these Rockefeller Republicans? And why were these people like Viguerie and Schlafly so supportive of that campaign? Because I think a lot of this does go back to the Goldwater campaign, even though the campaign ultimately failed.
Well, one distinguishing characteristic of Goldwater was that he was willing to have racist sub, what is the word? Subliminal racial terms in his campaign.
Basically using code language.
Code language, and you have something called the Southern Strategy, which begins to take shape then. And so, remember, you had Johnson pushing the Civil Rights Act in 1963, you had, 65, you had Martin Luther King, and you had, above all, school desegregation going on. And that had been 50s and 60s. And there were so many Southern areas, especially where, you know, you had to send the National Guard in to enforce school desegregation. It was a really hot button issue. And so a lot of the people who were opposed to the civil rights movement decided that they were going to start what they call Christian academies that would be all white and not subject to federal law because they were private. And they wanted to have a tax exempt status. And so that became the front line of the backlash to the civil rights movement. And Goldwater really lent himself to that movement and created a movement within the Republican Party that was embracing that backlash. You had Northern Republicans who were not comfortable with that. and who were more supportive of the civil rights movement. So, you know, they didn't come out and say, we're racist and we oppose civil rights. They played their politics and their political coalitions in a way that furthered that cause.
So basically, these figures that are going to form the CNP, they're ardently anti-communist, almost in like, I guess, a John Birch Society type way. Interestingly, the John Birch Society, like a lot of these figures, comes out of Texas and, you know, the Texas oil men. They're also very anti-civil rights, usually saying that the civil rights movement is a communist plot. I've heard that said in the past from some of these older figures from that era. And they're also very anti-feminist, and they're sort of coalescing around these issues.
That's correct. And you, the word communist becomes kind of a catch-all phrase for anything they oppose. So, but there is a rationale for that, because if you look at American history, a lot of the impetus for social reform comes from urban areas and northern cities where you have immigrants and you have a push for feminism. And it also became an area where you know, there was talk of socialism and communism and different parties and trade unions that were exploring these ideas. But yeah, communist just became this catch-all phrase for anything that you disliked. And the John Birch Society, you know, you're not talking about high standards of precision of research or language here. Martin Luther King was a communist. The feminists were communists. Everyone was communist. And you kind of look at it and you say, well, who exactly belonged to the Communist Party that you're talking about? And how does that fit in? But it was just a slur to throw around at a certain point. And it was a convenient slur because there had actually been, you know, a communist movement that had some expression in the United States in earlier periods of history, and you had McCarthyism and so on. I've never seen any evidence that a communist movement came anywhere near overthrowing the government of the United States or even changing its political fabric in any way. So I think that the backlash had a lot more steam than the movement ever had.
So this backlash is happening. And we mentioned Richard Viguerie, we mentioned Phyllis Schlafly. Let's talk next about Morton Blackwell, and more specifically, I really want to talk about Paul Weyrich, who is a very central figure in this book. And I have to say, when I found out that he was born and raised Catholic, although he later converted to Eastern Orthodox, I was like so disappointed as someone who grew up Catholic and was, you know, I come from a Catholic background, so I was like, oh, how this guy is making us look bad. Who is Paul Weyrich?
Okay. So Paul Weyrich, as you say, was Catholic, and he was somebody who was kind of an intellectual architect of this movement. And he actually thought that the Catholics were getting too liberal. That's why he left the church. And
right, after Vatican II, I assume.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because Vatican II was modernizing in all kinds of ways that he opposed. And, you know, to be fair, you know, as a journalist, I have written about a lot of aspects of religion, including Catholicism. And, you know, you've got liberalizing social movements in the Catholic Church, and then you've also got a backlash that is pushing back for doctrine that's long, long in the past. And so these groups look at these tensions and look for ways to exploit them politically. They look for hot button issues and then push them. And of course, for the Catholics, that has been abortion, above all. So Weyrich is someone who wanted to transform all of society. And he looked at the way the Democrats had the means of, you know, making movies that that educated people about civil rights and had student groups and you know, spoke to young people. And he said, we have to create a whole parallel world of backlash organizations that do all the same things. We need our own right-wing feature films. We need our own student associations where students are inculcated with our retrograde values. And we need to actually make war. I mean, he uses very, very military terminology on these liberal institutions, whether it's academia, whether it's the news media, whether it's entertainment. We need to defeat them and grind them into the ground. And they won't even know that we're attacking them, but we are. We're going to destroy them. So you have the third, they you know, sometimes called them the three horsemen of the apocalypse. You had Richard Viguerie, who was all about direct mail. You had Weyrich, who was about the architecture and the long-range vision of how this thing would work. And then you had Morton Blackwell, who was all about training and networking. And Blackwell, who was from Louisiana, set up the Leadership Institute, which would bring in people from all over the country and recruit them on local radio stations to come in and get training on how to run for office as conservatives and how to run political campaigns. And so these people would come and have his training sessions, and the sessions would be political technology and indoctrination. And he claims that his Leadership Institute has trained over 200,000 people in the United States.
So this is a well-oiled machine that they're setting up.
You're talking about lots of people and millions of dollars and donors who are big donors. I mean, we're talking about people who can write million-dollar checks, who are wired into this movement through the Council for National Policy and other partner organizations. So if you want these opulent training sessions and campuses and organizations and people on the payroll, all of that can happen and pretty much off the radar for the national press.
So essentially the CNP is this umbrella organization, a network that connects the money people to the strategists and whatnot. And we'll get to that, but I want to focus on Weyrich for one more moment here. It's interesting that you mentioned that there's diversity among Catholics, even politically, because I think that's also been true of Protestants, and that often gets glossed over. And in 1980, at a conference, I believe, or meeting of the religious right in Dallas, Weyrich is quoted as saying, and this quote illustrates that there was sort of a diversity when it came to Protestant America. He says, so many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down. These guys are deadly serious. They sort of want to take over and exploit these differences within religious communities, and they don't want certain people to vote. I mean, they're deadly serious about basically monkey-wrenching democracy.
So in that Paul Weyrich quote you just read, you can find the roadmap for many of the efforts of voter suppression that we're seeing right now in this election. And, you know, this has become endemic in American politics. What you have is Republican state houses in something like two-thirds of the states that where people lie awake nights figuring out how to make it impossible for their opponents to vote. Gerrymandering is one well-known way. Another way is to have certain regulations that disadvantage certain populations. So where they're going after, you know, what they understand is that very stable, older, white, rural voters are their sweet spot. So they want to do everything possible to have them amplify their voting ability and suppress the ability of groups that have traditionally voted for Democrats, which include African Americans and other minorities. For me as an American, it's shameful because this country did pass a Voting Rights Act, and there's been so much of a rollback in that that it really reflects badly on our whole sense of citizenship.
Now, in regards to the other comment I made, and then we'll talk about the founding of the CNP, there was a point where, you know, Carter was able to get the evangelical vote, and then Reagan gets in, 4 years later, and evangelicals have sort of flocked over to Reagan. Would you say that these three characters, this trio of the four horsemen, Viguerie, Weyrich, and Blackwell, play a big part in that?
Yes, they certainly tried to figure out how to peel those evangelical votes away. But another factor is that really before this period, the evangelicals were not particularly a voting bloc. And there were a lot of historical reasons for that. But one of them was that it wasn't so common for pastors to get up in church and tell people how to vote. They would talk about the Bible, you know, not about politics. And they thought that was the appropriate thing. And you know, according to the Constitution, I think that was correct. So there was a big campaign among these groups, including the CNP, to weaponize evangelicals and to convince them with heavy persuasion and lots of lobbying and money and other means that they should be political. They designed voting guides to pass out in the sanctuaries. And there was a lot of real pressure on both pastors and congregations to not just politicize their religion, but to push it hard towards right-wing republicanism. Now, Carter happened to be a Southern Baptist, and he has, I think, you know, has lived his faith in many ways. He's been a Sunday school teacher. He's been, you know, an honest husband and father. But he didn't push his faith politically. It was live and let live. This is my faith. You do, you know, I do me, you do you. Whereas the backlash against him was very much, we have to impose the tenets of our faith as we understand them on everyone else. And so that's one reason that they moved away from Carter. And the irony is that they put all of their political muscle behind Ronald Reagan, who wasn't a churchgoer, who was divorced, who didn't pay any attention to faith. But that's when you have it becoming transactional. They cut a deal. They say, all right, we'll give you the evangelical vote and you give us these policy elements. And that's what they've done with every candidate with varying degrees of success ever since Reagan, 1980. With Trump, they hit the ultimate transactional candidate. He has delivered on everything that he promised them, and he's now their guy.
Now, I want to get into Trump a little later because I don't think he was the CNP's first choice. But before we do that, how is the CNP founded? Because, you know, I think people are going to find that aspect interesting, given that I think its president, its first president, was none other than the author of the Left Behind series. So how does that come about?
Well, there was a group of – well, let me back up a bit. So in a lot of ways, the ground zero of this movement was a conference in Dallas in 1980, where a lot of these pastors came together and brought thousands of evangelicals to a sports arena to hear Ronald Reagan speak.
And is this the same conference where Weyrich made the comments about the voting?
Yeah. So okay. It was kind of this massive gathering of the Klans, and Reagan basically, you know, went up on stage and read their script to them. And that's when this new relationship was really sealed. So once they had that agreement, they had a win in the White House. And the following year, the leaders who had come out of this Dallas rally gathered in outside Washington. And Viguerie was one of the founders of it. And Tim LaHaye, who wrote the massive best-selling series Left Behind, all about the rapture and how people were going to be evaporated into heaven. Extraordinary literature, really. He became, you know, the first president, and they started building this coordinating body. And, you know, sometimes people read the book and they say, well, what does it do? And Richard DeVos, Betsy DeVos's father-in-law, was one of the leading figures. And he says, where the donors meet the doers, right? So they would have these secret meetings and they would discuss what their goals were and then who was going to pay for it and who was going to execute it and how it was going to be organized. And then they'd go off for 6 months and see, you know, what they could get done. So it was founded in 1981. And it has evolved and grown since then. But for many administrations, it's really been operating in the shadows.
And oftentimes, we don't even know the full membership lists unless they're leaked. You know, it is sort of shrouded in secrecy, which leads into the next point I wanted to make. The CNP has often been compared to the CFR. I think some of the early leadership of the CNP even said that they wanted to be the conservative equivalent of the CFR, and they got 501c3 status.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me because, you know, the CFR has always been a target of the far right in America. You know, oh, the CFR, they're conspiring globalism. And yet the CNP seems even more secretive than the CFR. So maybe we could talk about the CNP and how it's a reaction to the CFR and that 501c3 status.
Yeah, and you know, I'll do a disclaimer here. I've been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations for, I don't know, 20 or 25 years. And so I know the organization well. I know what it does. And as you say, it is a nonprofit organization and it has to meet certain requirements to have the tax-free status. So it has to function as an educational organization, which it does. And anybody can go on the Council on Foreign Relations website and they can find all kinds of publications and video materials and educational materials. Anybody can subscribe to Foreign Affairs, the journal. So the other aspect of it is that you have meetings at the Council on Foreign Relations where heads of state from other countries will speak and authors will speak. And you have a broad range of programs and membership where you can go from the right-wing Republican to the left-wing Democrat and beyond in terms of the membership and the questions. And it's a civil area of you know, to have that discourse. That none of those things apply to the Council for National Policy. They want the tax exempt status, but they don't have publications. They don't have educational materials. The Council on Foreign Relations has meetings that are covered by the press where, you know, people can be educated about foreign policy. The CNP doesn't do that. So they just tried to have this name that's similar, but they don't really walk the walk.
And basically, the membership of the CNP is all conservative, whereas the CFR has a mix.
Absolutely. And so the two organizations have no resemblance at all. And the other thing is, the Council on Foreign Relations, you would not see it favor one political party over another. You know, every campaign season, the candidates for the presidency come and give speeches, and both parties are represented. Democrats are not, you know, are not featured at the Council for National Policy. You know, don't even try to show up, because they have no interest in Democratic policy. So there's really not much similarity at all, other than having three letters to their initials.
I'm just curious, do you think that when, you know, elements of the right complain about the CFR or go off about the UN, do you think they're projecting a little bit with their sort of conspiracies about these organizations? Because it seems like the CNP, like I said, is almost like the real shadowy version of an organization like that.
Yeah, I think I fear that there may be some hypocrisy involved. And, you know, again, I think that as Americans, we underestimate our regional divides. So I will say that the Council on Foreign Relations is centered. It's based in New York and Washington. It is indeed an East Coast phenomenon. That's where it started. That's where it's existed. And the CNP, if it had its true headquarters, I think they'd be in the South and they'd be very rooted in the extractive industries. And, you know, we just have a kind of regional contest in that regard. And I think Americans like to have this myth that we're just like this happy old unified country. And I just don't see the evidence for that. I even see these divisions in places like Pennsylvania where, you know, you'll have a cultural divide between East and West, you know, much less, you know, North and South of the United States, where you have some of the old rivalries from the Civil War that never went away.
Now, that brings me to another point. In a way, Shadow Network does give some criticism to the Democratic Party and maybe that what I guess right-wingers would call the coastal elites. But it's very different from the sort of Tucker Carlson whining about the sort of coastal elites. What you're sort of pointing out is that in referring to parts of the country as flyover country, you know, the coastal elites have sort of ignored that organizations like the CNP have gone into these parts of the country, created a media empire, and essentially, I don't want to use the term brainwashed, but essentially sort of taken over the media in these parts of the country and gets them to vote for Republican candidates as a result.
Yeah, and a big part of my book, Shadow Network, is a critique of what's happened in media systems. So when I was growing up in Oklahoma in the 60s and 70s, you had a strong local newspaper culture. You had radio stations that did news coverage, right? And in the ensuing, you know, 50 or 60 years, you've had the media get more power on the coast. Right now, you've got three very healthy newspapers, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post are doing great. And the newspapers in the middle of the country representing the interests of the people who live here are either dead or on life support. And there are economic factors like, you know, the migration of advertising to, you know, digital platforms. Okay, fine. But this country just let these newspapers die. And I don't think you can have democracy without accurate information. So if you say, oh, well, they're just not economical, we'll just let people live without journalism, then you have these other forces that come to fill the vacuum. And what I found through my research and my travels is that you have fundamentalist radio, you have right-wing talk radio coming in where they're really purveying misinformation, falsehood. They don't have a professional journalist in the room. They don't care about professional journalism. They don't do fact-checking. They don't do corrections. They do what would be called in various settings propaganda. And so part of what I've done in my research is drive around with these stations on and listen to them say that Hillary Clinton is a demon. Okay, literally, that she's a demon and that God hates the Democrats because Hillary Clinton's a demon and Beto O'Rourke is the son of Satan, right? Now, this is not news coverage. You cannot fact check these statements, right? And these populations are getting, you know, it's just awash in their environment. And then they go home and they turn on Fox News, which has echoes of this kind of misinformation. And I feel that if people on the East Coast and the West Coast were serious about maintaining democracy, they'd find ways to support the information services and the education of their fellow citizens in the middle.
Are there any stations in particular that you can point towards in this regard? I think one that stood out for me was Salem. Could you talk a little bit to that?
Well, Salem Media is, I believe, tied for the fifth largest radio broadcaster in the country. And it is, its two founders who are still very active are leading figures in the Council for National Policy. And they've got a whole bevy of online platforms. They have a book publishing component. And so this is one place where you'll get a lot of this programming, that is very one-sided, and they're not the most virulent of all of them. I would say the most virulent might be American Family Radio, which is out of Tupelo, Mississippi, and it's been very connected with the Council for National Policy since the start. And, you know, I've listened to broadcasts on this radio station. And, for example, I cite some programming. It is a collection of stations. It's a network. Where after the Las Vegas shooting, they said the only problem with it, that was the will of God, that Las Vegas had all of these people die from the mass shooting, and that the only problem was that the Democrats wanted to hold hearings on gun control. And that was just exploiting the tragedy because it was God's will. And the problem was holding hearings on gun control. So whatever happens in public events, they're going to have a very predetermined response to it that will be critical of Democrats and will promote the Republicans. One thing that's really tragic about it is how they play abortion. And that's with, you know, this whole media empire. They claim that Democrats support what they call birthday abortion, which is abortion on demand up to the day of birth. And their radio stations put it out. Trump has actually used this language because he uses their language. So has Ted Cruz. And it's just false. I mean, I have scoured the record. No Democrat has ever said that a woman should be able to be 9 months pregnant and walk into a doctor and say, oh, I changed my mind. Please abort my full-term baby. That's not a thing. That's not a policy. It's a lie. It's a lie. But they repeat it over and over again. And I have been in conversations with people who say, oh, how could I vote for Democrats? Because they like to murder newborn babies. And you're like, no, they don't. Yeah, you know, whatever. Whatever policy conversation you want to have, it should be based on fact.
I guess that gets into really the genius, in a way, of the Richard Viguerys and the Paul Weyricks of the world. They recognized very early on the truth doesn't really matter to them as much as winning. And in recognizing that, they decide, you know, maybe we should just start creating a sort of parallel universe of facts.
Exactly.
And in a way, this is made possible through something that happens in the Reagan administration with the rollback of the Fairness Doctrine. Maybe you could explain that. What was the Fairness Doctrine And what has been the deleterious effect of its rollback?
Yeah, well, you know, I've studied a fair amount of media history. And, you know, if you look at the foundations of American news media, if you go back, you know, to the 19th century, the political parties often founded newspapers, and there'd be rival newspapers in a market, right? So you'd have the Democrats' newspaper and the Republicans' newspaper. And when they started moving towards broadcasting, they created the Fairness Doctrine to say that you shouldn't have one political party that owns the entire media system in a town. So if you had a radio station in a town and it said something that was critical of a Republican said by a Democrat, then the Republican should have the right of response and represent their case, right? And so the Fairness Doctrine was just assuming that if you only had one outlet in a town, you needed equal time. And so that was kind of a, I believe it was a positive force in American political culture, because it meant that people could hear different perspectives and not be brainwashed by one party or the other. And the Democrats supported this idea traditionally. Under the Reagan administration, there was a big push to get rid of it. There was also a question of technology, where they said, well, if we have all these cable stations, then everybody's going to have access to every possible opinion. I think what they didn't allow for was the rise of something like Fox News. Because Fox came along and said, we don't have to follow these other rules. We can be more aggressive. We can be less fact-based. And nobody can stop us, right? We can be more partisan, and nobody can stop us. And so all of a sudden you go from the kind of polite and thoughtful news environment that you had on the networks in the 1960s, say, you know, Walter Cronkite, right? He was not a rabid partisan of any kind.
Most and trusted then, man in America, right?
That's right. And he was just kind of the voice of calm and reason. And then you go, you know, a few decades later, and these screaming matches on cable television and this highly partisan environment, and you've lost something in American political culture. You've lost civility. You've lost the respect for fact-based reporting. You've lost the emphasis on fairness. And a lot of people who are in the audience don't even realize what they've lost.
I was going to add to that really briefly, if I could. There are people that I've talked to that I feel like can't even tell the difference between reporting and opinion editorials. Like, to me, someone like Tucker Carlson or Bill O'Reilly, they're opinion editorialists. It's not the same as you know, fact-based reporting.
That's right. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time practicing and teaching traditional journalism. And the one of the problems I see is that, you know, if you're in a journalism school, those rules are hammered into you. And if it's just an opinion piece without reporting, then it goes on the editorial page and people look at the editorial page and it says in big bold letters, editorial. But the news pages, you know, are news. And now with these new digital platforms and the way that we're scrambling to keep journalism alive, those distinctions have become blurrier, both for the audience and for the people who are producing them. And so I think that we need to restore some of our older values back to the mix and not just let it be the Wild West free for all, so that people can make informed decisions.
Now, I want to fast forward to the CNP and Trump, but first I have to ask you one part that's a very small section of the book that I had to ask you about because it's an area of history that I'm very interested in. You reported on issues related to El Salvador and, you know, that moment in time where you had the support of the U.S. Behind right-wing death squads in, Central America. Could you comment on the CNP connections to that sordid aspect of the Reagan era? What's the connection there?
Well, JG, I had no idea I was going to stumble across this in my research. As far as I knew, my experience reporting in El Salvador was a totally separate chapter. And then to my astonishment, I found these clippings about how the CNP had sponsored a visit for Roberto Dabuisson to Washington and had been involved in various areas of support for Dabuisson. Now, Dabuisson was somebody I interviewed in El Salvador, who was one of the leading figures from the death squads. He was involved in planning the murder, the assassination of Archbishop Romero, and many, many other people. And so he was regarded as just a terrifying figure in El Salvador. And he was brought to Washington, and there was actually a quote in one of the news articles from one of the young Republicans who attended the function, and he said something like, "Oh yeah, the press gives death squads a bad name." And I was like, "Yeah, well, if you see their handiwork, I'm sorry, I'm speechless because the death squads of El Salvador were so murderous. They tortured, they killed nuns, they killed children. And the idea that the CNP or anyone involved with it could be supportive of their work is horrifying.
I brought it up because to me it highlights, I'm not just so sure that something like the CNP or what Vigory has called the new right, I'm not so sure it's actually about Christianity so much as it's about things like money and power. I mean, you have the Koch brothers being involved with the CNP, and the Koch brothers have basically said, you know, we're socially liberal, but, you know, we mainly care about economic issues. So you can believe whatever you want socially and disagree with us, but we'll support you if you believe in our economic ideals.
Yeah, but you know, I have never found any evidence that the Koch brothers belonged to the CNP. And so the Koch operations are fascinating. I think they're really their own thing. And so they'll look at other organizations like the CNP, and at certain periods they'll say, okay, we have common interests and we'll find ways to collaborate, or we'll fund your operations and you'll fund our operations. But they're not really joiners. And so you were talking about the membership list of the CNP. The Southern Poverty Law Center obtained a copy of the 2014 membership list and published it. And so at that point, you could see that the Koch brothers had an organization called Americans for Prosperity, and the head of it belonged to the CNP. But now we have access to more recent membership lists, and that person no longer belongs. So reading the tea leaves, I think the Koch brothers have somewhat distanced themselves from the CNP. There's only one Koch brother left, by the way. The others have
right,
died.
Right. Do you think that money and power play a role in the CNP? Is it all sort of religious ideologues? What is going on there?
After staring at this question for over 3 years, I would say that the big money people, especially in the oil industry, but not only the oil industry, have figured out the way to use evangelical Christians. And it makes me angry because you've got a lot of good people who are sincerely religious and who want to do good. And you get these people who want to manipulate them for political purposes and flood them with disinformation and pressure them and, lead them into actions that contradict their spiritual values.
Right. Well, it's like how, you know, you'll hear these right-wing talk show hosts who claim to be Christian basically playing a language game where they'll say things like freedom and justice. And when they say freedom and justice, that's really code for deregulate, don't tax the rich.
Yeah, and you know, it hurts to watch how this plays out, because they'll say, "Oh, you need to have freedom from regulations." Well, then they go into communities, and the freedom is from environmental regulations that give the children drinkable water, and that give communities a way not to have cancer-causing toxic waste dumps. And so they saddle them with these environmental dangers in the name of freedom. And that's just not right.
Now, before we close out, I want to briefly get into Trump and the CNP, because I get the impression that the sort of religious right, Trump was not their first pick. It was Ted Cruz. So how has the CNP dealt with Trump? And also, maybe you could preview an article that you have coming out concerning America's frontline doctors. Maybe we could tie that all together briefly here.
Oh my goodness! Well, that's a
we can take a few
package.
Minutes if you have it.
Okay. As you say, the CNP initially felt that their favorite candidate was Ted Cruz, and their second favorite was Marco Rubio, and among their fundamentalist pastors, they regarded Donald Trump as a rather sinful man who had been a sexual predator and lacking in honesty, and not someone who expressed much religious sentiment. Then Trump won the primaries, and they had to figure out what they were going to do, because it was going to be Trump versus Clinton, and Trump wasn't necessarily going to make it on his own. He didn't have much by the way of campaign finance. He didn't have the ground game for the election. He needed their support. And there were a series of meetings, including a very large meeting in New York City in June of 2016, where they cut the deal. And they said, all right, we'll give you those elements you need to win, and you give us what we want. And one of the biggest asks that they had was for judges. They wanted conservative judges on the federal courts, and they had a list of judges, that nominations that they approved, and they gave Trump this list, and he said, I will appoint judges from your list. And the list was drawn up by three groups that work with, that are, have membership in the Council for National Policy: the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, and the National Rifle Association. Now, I ask you what the logic is for the National Rifle Association to be choosing who our federal judges should be, right? I mean, I'm not sure what the qualification for that is, but that was a deal that was cut, and Trump has followed through to the letter. And the professional lawyers associations, the American Bar Association, have looked on in horror, because some of these judges are totally unqualified, and they get a judgeship for life. The only qualification they have is that they are right wing and they support these groups and their agenda. In some cases, they've never tried a case as a lawyer. They're in their 30s and they're totally inexperienced as lawyers. But there they are on the federal bench as a result of these organizations pushing them. And these people are going to be defining elements of American life for generations to come. They're young people, and they have these appointments for life. So we now are going into this 2020 electoral season, and there's kind of a problem, because if they're going to continue to appoint judges until they're the majority and they can define every element of our national life,
even if
to do that.
I was going to say, even if the majority of the voting populace doesn't agree with those judges, basically this is a way to circumvent democracy.
Exactly. So if a Republican state wants to gerrymander like crazy and suppress votes, and somebody takes it to court, the judge goes with the gerrymandering. And we've had that happen. And they've tipped some courts on, you know, in the regional level already. And I believe that we're now at a point where they haven't appointed over half of the judges yet, but if they have another 4 years, they will. And we can expect a lot of social policies to be rolled back if that happens. They will seek to transform this country. I mean, they've declared that. So there is a kind of go for broke attitude here. One of the things that they have to do is they feel that COVID and the economic lockdowns have been a problem for Trump. First of all, he can't hold his big rallies when there's a total lockdown. Second of all, it constrains the economy. And one of the elements of his platform was supposed to be a healthy economy. So they need to reopen things as rapidly as possible, they believe. So that's where a group called America's Frontline Doctors comes in. And I recommend that your listeners look for the article. You can search for it with my name and the Washington Spectator. It comes out on Tuesday. And it tells the story of how the Trump campaign and the Council for National Policy leadership organized some doctors to push hydroxychloroquine as a cure for COVID. It is not. The research has established that it is not a cure for COVID. It doesn't prevent COVID. And it also involves some real medical problems and some dangers when it's used. But the idea is that if they convince people to think it's a cure, then they don't need lockdowns. They don't need economic restrictions. They can hold rallies because there's a cure. Now, this is a policy that's being promoted. They held a press conference in Washington in July announcing this, and then the members of this group have been interviewed on the Christian Broadcasting Network. They've been pushed on Breitbart and all of this right-wing parallel universe of media.
Yeah, I believe that Dr. was on Tucker Carlson's show. She was featured in The Blaze. Some of her background has been questioned. So now the right wing is claiming that she's been censored by big tech, whatever that means. It's a sad state of affairs.
What it means is that her press conference in Washington in July was initially posted on YouTube and Twitter and Facebook, and all three of them took it down after a few hours because it violated their codes on misinformation about COVID. So that's why they've needed this alternate media system to promote their ideas. And I go into a lot of detail on this story in the Washington Spectator piece. And I've interviewed, several legitimate COVID doctors who are horrified that this is happening because, first of all, you actually need hydroxychloroquine to treat autoimmune diseases like lupus. So this is causing a shortage of hydroxychloroquine for the legitimate uses. But the other problem is with some patients, it can cause heart arrhythmia and other cardiac problems. So if you're prescribing it for COVID, it won't help with the COVID, but it could cause serious problems on other fronts. And it's a cynical exercise because they're not presenting any research that they're correct. It's misusing medical misinformation for political purposes. And that's very tragic.
I was going to say it's also misusing the media, because I think what these hydroxychloroquine supporters will say, who think we can use it for COVID, they'll say, well, look, the media talked about it early on. And there were, as you note, high hopes for it. But as time went on, we found it's not going to work for COVID. And they just completely ignore that. And they say, well, that's a conspiracy. They don't want you to know that it can be used as a cure. And you can't argue with these people because they're living in a parallel universe.
Well, and I think the other factor is I've got another article coming out in the Times Literary Supplement this month that talks about the war against science. So here you have COVID hitting the United States hard in early 2020. I was in New York City through the month of April when we had over 1,000 people in the city dying every day. Okay. It was a total nightmare. And it was new. We didn't know the basic elements of this new virus. So people were trying to figure out, well, do masks help? We don't know yet. We have to do the research. Is hydroxychloroquine something that will help? We don't know. We have to do the research. That's how science functions, right? You ask a question, you do the research, you get some answers. So if people say, oh, well, they didn't know about, you know, they said contradictory things a few months ago about masks and hydroxychloroquine. Yeah, they needed to do the research. They did it. And now they know. That's how science works. But if you don't believe in science and you don't believe in facts, then you are very easily manipulated. And again, these populations will be paying the price. You know, the people who go to the rallies and the people who don't wear masks and the people who don't believe in the science are the ones that are going to die. They're the ones who are going to take the disease home to their grandparents. And it will keep unfolding as our national tragedy.
And I would add that I think it's a really sad thing. I've had some friends say, you know, and there are people who really hate Trumpism. And I completely share that hatred. But I've had people say to me, well, if these people want to go without masks and they want to go to the Trump rallies, let them. That's just Darwinism in action. They're going to win a Darwin Award. And I don't know. I don't like that attitude. I think these are citizens, too, in a way. I think they've been taken advantage of and led down the wrong path.
Absolutely. I mean, look, you know, I was born in this country. I've lived in it my whole life. And I do feel that at our best, we care for one another. I don't say, you know, I want you to die because you vote for a different political party than I do. No, I say, what's our common good? We vote, we have kids. Let's have the best outcome for the most people. You know, that for me is the American way. It's not like I'll suppress your vote and I'll let you die and divide and conquer. I don't think that's who we are as a nation.
I agree 110%. And on a closing note, and then I promise to let you go, you know, one of the few other journalists who have been covering the CNP in one form or another is a fellow by the name of Max Blumenthal. And his dad, Sidney Blumenthal, worked with the Clintons. And it's interesting, supposedly when Hillary Clinton mentioned the vast right-wing conspiracy, infamously, and right-wingers made fun of that, and they still do, that was Sidney Blumenthal that is alleged to have come up with that term. And it's interesting to me because it seems like there is a vast right-wing conspiracy. And in fact, Richard Viguerie, in his book, Takeover, says to the extent that Hillary Clinton's vast right-wing conspiracy ever existed, it met at Elaine's in my home in McLean from 1975 until 1984. It seems like this vast right-wing conspiracy bit may have a little bit more of a grain of truth to it than people realized.
Oh, yeah, Richard Viguerie was boasting about it. Yeah, he's like, yeah, that's us. And, you know, I think it goes back to something else that you said earlier, which is the way they said, we're going to win at all costs. We don't have to use facts. We don't have to care for our fellow citizens. We don't have to follow any of the rules. We don't have to be honest. We don't have to be compassionate. We just have to win. And that's how they've played this game. And I've been very interested to see that some of the biggest opponents and the most passionate opponents to this movement are Republicans who've said, wait a minute, we're decent people. We don't hate on other Americans. They've hijacked our party. And so they have been some of the people who've been working against them the hardest. And I think that's what we need. The United States needs a strong two-party system where both parties can work together to solve common problems. And we know what those problems are. People need education. They need medical care. They need a clean environment. There are ways to do this. And, you know, we've done it before. So I think that it's just a matter of getting our political system back on track so it's functioning for our mutual benefit.
Well, I want to thank you and Nelson for this informative conversation. How can my listeners get a hold of Shadow Network?
Well, I would say the first choice is to go to their local independent bookstore. And if they don't have it, they can order it there because bookstores are important to support. There are also other places online that they know about where they can find it too. And that's fine. And that's the book is called Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. I've written a number of books and I'm continuing to write articles, and I just hope I can help inform people as we go through this critical period of our history.
Thank you again, Ann Nelson, for coming on Parallax Views.
Sure, thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ann Nelson, veteran journalist and author of the new book, highly recommended by yours truly, Shadow Network, Media, Money, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. And of course, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. Producers credit shoutouts to Emilia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Mickey, Zach, Gratz, and Ted. Please consider joining those listeners in supporting me at patreon.com at the $10 or $15 tier. If you would like your own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, it is listeners like those who get that producer's credit shout out that allow this show to keep going. Believe it or not, although I do have an advertisement at the beginning of the show, most of my ability to continue producing this program on a regular basis is due to the support of my Patreon subscribers. So again, if you want to support me, patreon.com/ParallaxViews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.